This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time.
Catherine. Hi.
Yes. Hi.
This week I want to talk about writing and motherhood, which is ridiculous that we haven't kind of fully...
I know, I'm really surprised we haven't touched on this.
We haven't talked about it as a topic.
Part of our lives.
Yeah, we were just saying, oh, I think we've talked about it. We haven't used it as a topic. And I feel like we can't avoid it anymore. The interview today is with debut author Anna Downs, who speaks really very beautifully and honestly and intimately about her experience after the birth of her second child, which I think is...
I should also add, you have written a book called The Mother Fault.
I have.
So I feel like that sets a particular frame.
It does. You know, when you do those things where you don't realise, I remember us talking about you, like me saying, you're going to be asked about your work in local government or, you know, local council. And you're like, yeah, I know I will be, but you don't actually think about it.
Yeah. We can put it off. Yeah. I also submitted the second, when I first signed my contract, that was a 2-book contract. The title of the second manuscript is Swallow, which sounds so horrendously sexual.
Isn't that why they signed it? They think you're writing a little bit of local council erotica.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Other lovely thing that we got this week was a listener question via email, which you can always do to us. So it's from Elizabeth Passmore. And she asks, Dear Catherine and Kate, I'm an aspiring writer struggling with the demands of small children, 5 months, 3 years and 5 years, which just, she says, would love to hear you discuss on the podcast how do you write with small kids? Apart from the obvious, finding money for babysitting, how do people attend Varuna? How do they find the brain space even when they do have a half hour spare? And I think the first thing that we need to say to Elizabeth is just take a pause if you would like, because you are in the trenches if you have a 5-month-old and a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. I don't think I was actually writing at that stage with such small
kids. How old were your kids when you started writing Skylarking?
Like older. I remember having the need to write, this very real need to write, while I was breastfeeding Etta. I signed up for a writing course because I was, I felt it like a hunger. I really, really, really wanted to be writing. But you know, she was 18 months old by the time I was writing Skylarking. What about you?
I had started obsessively writing probably just a little bit before I fell pregnant, really. And so Tilly's arrival was that thing of, oh, my God, happy, joy. Let's assume all that in every aspect of the conversation. We always sort of talk about that. But it felt like, what happens now? Like, this is probably – I'm probably not going to be able to do this for ages. In reality, with one child, you can actually write a bit in nap times, you know, if your child does – take to sleeping. With two, it was definitely harder.
Yeah, because you were pregnant while we were studying.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I was the person who was, I think the only time I went to RMIT, I was basically pregnant, which is such a strange moment around people who have just graduated from high school. Like, can you get less appealing as someone to talk to than a mature age pregnant person?
There's the mature age student over there with her pregnant
belly. See them cringing.
Oh my goodness. So Elizabeth, having said that, like, give yourself a break if you're not getting writing done at the moment, because, you know, wow, you're deep in it. But also we wanted to honor your questions with our honest responses. And we should also say that we're talking very much about the motherhood experience, because that's our experience, but also this equates, I would say, across parenthood in general and in caring responsibilities, like, take from this what you will. Catherine, you've spoken about this a little bit before in terms of your writing routine, but how did you and do you continue to get the writing done around your children and their lives?
I will say, for Elizabeth, I definitely wrote most of the helpline, an hour a day. That is how I wrote for years. That was even before kids, just because, you know, like I liked doing it, but that was all the time I was really willing to carve out at that point. I think you could even cut back that to half an hour a day. For me, like the ongoing touch point is what helps. I think also kids, while you don't have a lot of writing time, you often do get a lot of thinking time, and thinking time can really make the writing time worth more. I basically, the only other time that I used was I gave up exercise. So generally, yeah, so I joined, I was a member at a gym, I used the creche. I always picked the creche slot that had the longest time, and I never did classes because classes were too long. So max, I would do half an hour of exercise and then I would do an hour of writing. I would never shower. Basically, in those early years, anything I could do with a child, I would do with a child. I would never go to the supermarket by myself. I would never clean when kids were asleep. I would never do anything. I would write if I was alone, and anything else I would do with a child.
I think that's really, really smart and useful advice. Thank you. You did go to Varuna. I remember you talking about this with when you had quite a small child. I can't remember who.
And she was 12 months.
12 yeah. months, that's right. And we also obviously regularly do our musk retreats. So how do you make that work?
It's a bit easier when they're a bit older. I do always remember Varuna. So Varuna, generally, if you get a residency, they give you 2 weeks. And I had sort of hoped that they would let me take that in dribs and drabs. They don't. They will let you, though, take it in two lots of 1 week. So that obviously was a much easier thing to come at. Varuna was great. Like, for me, the memory of going, particularly that first time, is always two things, though. Like, on the one hand, it was the first bit of validation ever. It was so much freedom. I was surrounded by other writers. That was so special. But I do always think, oh, my God, Tilly was so young. I remember the phone call I had. I think I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, where the power steering.
Oh, that's right. Oh, my God, that's right.
Yeah, so I always remember Varuna, but I always remember that phone call from Carney by the side of the road as well, and just that feeling of just guilt and anxiety. And, yeah, so it's interesting. Varuna, so much about motherhood and riding really sit together for that.
Kay Kerr has got a great piece somewhere, or maybe I saw her write about it on Instagram, or maybe in the interview where she talks about, because she had quite a small child.
Yeah.
When she and again, I remember her posting about it. She was heading off to go to Varuna and just feeling
That's
such empathy
right.
for
that
her.
Was her first big thing away from her.
Yeah, that party. Like it's going to be amazing for you, and it will be so good. But I totally feel you because it's also
it's massive.
Yeah, massive. Massive bodily.
So, oh, well, there is a body. I think I weaned Tilly. Like she was 12 months old, but
yeah.
I think I was definitely considering that. So there was absolutely a bodily element. For mask, you've also been to Varuna and
yeah.
you've been on, is it Bundanon?
Yeah.
You went to Bundanon as well, didn't you?
Yeah.
How does it work for you?
I think it works via a whiteboard is my key advice. So, you know, it works via the village. Really, that my partner makes it that possible because he takes up the slack on a day-to-day basis of where I would normally have, because normally for the last couple of years at least I've been working and writing from home most days. But also that entire other village of other school parents, my parents, in-laws, you know, people who will pick up kids and deposit them in other places. And I always reckon that the couple of weeks before I go, not only am I really kind of itemizing my planning for what I want to get done in the project, like making sure I've got all the books ready, all the readings downloaded, that I've kind of mapped out to myself, which is often really easy if you're going to something like Varuna or Bundanon and you've got a grant, you've already had to do this, but, you know, mapping out, this is where I want to be, this is the work I'm going to do. So mapping that out for myself, and then also, you know, it's sometimes a hell of a lot of work getting that schedule ready for who's taking this kid to basketball and picking that person up. But what I love about that is that basically then when I go to the retreat, I switch that off. It helps that at Musk where we go, we have really shitty phone reception.
That is the best part about it, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it means that you
– it's big hill. In
yeah,
order to
and you can't get those like, so-and-so's not waiting in the spot she should be. Who should I, you know? Mm. So you really do have to hand the whole thing over, hand out the phone numbers to the right people and say, you've got this. And, you know, of course people have got it. But the reason that I continue to do those retreats, and I'm sure it's the same for you, is because, and I've said this before in here, that week or 4 days or whatever is like times 500 the amount of work that I can get done at home.
It is work-wise, but also life nourishment-wise, isn't it? Like, it really serves both purposes.
Yeah. And I think you often have, they're often the times you have quite extraordinary breakthroughs in your work as well, or can make those sometimes, you know, your work needs a really big shift. And I think that immersion time that you get when you're away from normal life allows you to do that big shift. Whereas if you have to start onto the big shift and then go pick up the kids and take them to basketball and go and do that thing, then it's harder to get the momentum. Okay. Elizabeth asks about, you know, money for babysitting, how you make that time work. How do you make it work financially in your family?
I've never had a babysitter. Have you? Do you ever get babysitters? Oh, I mean, we've used grandparents, but we don't.
Use grandparents. Our children don't take very well to babysitters, really? Unfortunately.
I think mine would be thrilled. I remember being thrilled having babysitters. I would get one to hold one end of the skipping rope, tie the other end to the clothesline, and just skip for hours.
Oh my gosh! If my child did that, what kind of child were you?
Financially, well, we are in, I suppose, the position where Oscar is not at school yet. So Carney and I are both working part-time till he goes to school. So I'm not really sure what next year is going to look like. I'm not sort of grappling with that at the moment. But I work part-time as an engineer. It is not creative in any way, shape or form. And I'm happy with the split between sort of paid work and writing life. I think it'd be really hard to be relying on books as a source of income.
Yeah.
You basically have to be a book a year author, and that's a pretty big ask. Yeah.
We've talked about this before in terms of transparency about what do they call it? Work transparency. Over the last few years, we have got away with the fact that basically my partner has supported us financially. We do things like still pay for after school care on certain days where I'm like, that's my big working day.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. And always on the same night. And it's like my big day. And also a day where I could do meetings or that kind of thing. And basically I've been used to the hustle, I suppose, on the side for book related work and writing related work until this book deal, which has given me a bit of space to write these two books at least, and then we'll see what it looks like on the other side. But the important thing I think there is that I continue to say I'm paying for that after school care. And like you saying, you know, you kind of have to do it. You've got the kids in the creche or whatever, like do the work in that part. It's been really validating for me.
I think also for Elizabeth, the only other thing is when kids are that young, if everything feels interminable, like it will go forever, but actually the balance shifts, and you know, it's a pendulum and all that sort of stuff, but it comes and it goes, you know, it's not permanent. You will get to write.
I was
talking to Cass Moriarty, and I think this bit we said outside of the interview, but she written The Promised Seeds, Parting Words is her second, fabulous books, didn't write a word of fiction aside from, you know, as a high schooler and as a primary schooler until she was 40.
Yeah.
And has six kids.
Does she have six kids?
Six kids. That's more than one hand of kids.
That's maybe what makes her so generous and extraordinary.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. That's why she's such a lovely, just thoughtful
person. I don't think
person.
That I can be inspired to have an extra four just to be as generous and lovely as Cass. Oh, but
I would have another kid in a heartbeat, but can't.
You heard it here first, people. You heard it here first.
Oh, I love
Catherine's
that.
New release is a new baby. Are there any resources, strategies, advice that worked particularly well for you?
I think the best thing you can do is learn the art of patience, which no one is inherently good at. I'm certainly not.
No.
But I guess the more you engage with social media can be a double-edged sword. It can be a wonderful thing, but it can also be something that you can sort of put on a hair vest and swipe yourself sort of with. Because you see social media is so full of the end product.
Yeah.
And there's long roads that get to those end products.
There's
Yeah. You have time and it will take time.
It will take time.
You think 5 years, an hour a day for 5 years, something like that. But if you didn't do the hour a day for 5 years, the 5 years would still pass.
I feel like that's
helpful or not. But
I
remember Claire Strawn in a class once saying something about wanting things before you're ready.
Yeah.
Because really you want it all. Like you want to put that first book out, win this Stella Prize.
Yeah.
You know, second one gets turned into a film.
Give it to me all now.
Yeah, exactly. But it's bird by bird, you know?
Yeah, it totally is bird by bird. You said then about the social media and the hair vest, and it just made me think because I wanted to mention this as well. You know, the less in terms of motherhood itself, I found less kind of Byron mums and more of Em Rusciano, Clem Ford, you know, people like that who are very real about what the experience is.
I
think that can help, you know, I think that can help saying, you know, it's actually also really shit. And I think that the other thing is that, I mean, I've thought about this so much because it was part of what led to the book. But the incredible writing from Mothers, Jamila's book that she edited, the Motherhood, the one that you and I both got, Rachel Power's book, Motherhood and Creativity, like the more stories you can hear of women who have navigated it, waited till the kids were old, however they've navigated it, done the 1 hour a day, done the Kate Grenville surfboard on the lap in the car, you know, all the ways in which you navigate it, the things that people have given up or tried. So you might be like the Nina Kenwood and you know, make it out on the weeks after her baby was born and do that stuff, which was incredible. You might choose to say, okay, no, I'm not doing anything.
That conversations with friends episodes. You know, I think they had writers group challenges and Nina was winning the challenges.
Yeah.
I love that.
But I think, you know, there's no real way to do it. And that's why I have found enormous, you know, I'm obsessed with all the writing books, but I think more so than anything, I search for the bits where writers who are also mothers write about that experience and I kind of eat it all up. And I think that's, you know, I'm just proofing the final pages for the book. And in the acknowledgements, I've said, for my girls, you know, thank you. And it's partly about that stuff about Musk and being gone for so long at different times. You know, thank you for recognizing that I am your mother and a writer both. I am both of those things. It's going to make me cry. I haven't said that before.
So lovely.
But I think, and there was a quote that I wanted to put in the front of the book, but you know, I put too many in. It's by Rufy Thorpe, who wrote an incredible article called Mother, Writer, Monster, Maid, which I don't know if is available anymore, but if I can find a link, I will. And she says of motherhood, it is lovely, it is intolerable, it is both. And I think that's what, now we're both going to cry. But that is both. So Elizabeth Passmore, I don't know if we have been helpful or not. I hope we have. I wanted to mention that Catherine, you just said about the Nina Kenwood, Bronte Coates and Emily Gale conversation about in conversations with friends and they talk about motherhood. Alice Robinson has talked about it with us. Penny Russin has. And today's interview, obviously, with Anna Downs as well. So I hope that there is something useful in there for you. Anna Downes grew up in Sheffield, UK. She studied drama at Manchester University before winning a place at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art and moving to London to pursue an acting career. Her acting credits include TV shows such as EastEnders and Casualty, as well as a long-running stage production of The Dresser in London's West End. In 2009, Anna left to go travelling with her Australian partner, a trip that included a stint working as a live-in housekeeper on a remote French estate where the seeds for The Safe Place were sown. Anna now lives on the central coast of New South Wales with her husband and two children. In July 2020, The Safe Place is being published simultaneously in Australia, New Zealand, UK and North America, with several other countries to follow. Anna Downes, welcome to the First Time Podcast.
This is great.
It's so exciting because I have to tell our listeners the background in that I met you for the first time last year in Sydney at a First Time Podcast event, and you were delightful and you said, you know, oh yeah, I'm an author. And then it quickly became apparent to me that you were that author. You were the author with the hot debut who'd got this two-book deal and an international auction, and you'd sold all these foreign rights already, and you'd been to the ABS and you didn't even have a book out yet. And I was like, oh my gosh, you're that person. So I want to start in an unusual place, Anna Downes. Please tell me, what were the 2019 ABS Awards like? What did you wear? Did you get selfies with any famous people? Tell us, please.
Oh, so many good questions with long answers. All right. So it was like you shall go to the ball, Cinderella. And it was amazing. When I got the invitation, I was like, oh my God, I get to go. And I wore a dress that had one very big sleeve, and it was kind of slinky, but it was also, you know, I just felt amazing in it. And I went round to my sister's house in the hours before, and she's got a friend who's a hairdresser, hairstylist, and he came over and we did, you know, I got my hair done, and we had champagne, and it was brilliant. It was hilarious as well, because I was like, why am I going again? Like, what? When I introduce myself to people, they're going to be like, why are you here? Anyway, but there was an amazing moment because I met everybody. Oh, there were so many amazing moments. I met my agent and my publisher beforehand at a bar, and we signed the contract.
So we were all dressed up
and Martin was in a tux, and, you know, we popped the champagne, we signed the contracts, and then we went on up to the venue, to the exhibition centre, and, you know, we walked through a lobby that was very, very empty and kind of museum-like, and we got in a lift and we went up, and Martin's kind of looking at me out the corner of his eye, kind of checking to see if I'm appropriately excited, which I was. And then we got up the top, and the lift doors opened, and it was like, the book industry was there, and all these, like, you know, like, it was just like stepping into a new world. And, you know, oh God, it was like all these people, and I could see Trent Dalton and Holly Raeland and, you know, all these people. It was unreal.
I love it so much.
I got no selfies with anyone. I was so close to going up to Usher to ask for a selfie, and I didn't, because I was just so scared. I was like, I just sat in my seat the whole night pretty much just going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. It was brilliant.
I love it. And, I mean, what a beginning to this to this fairy tale story, which I absolutely know has not been a fairy tale the whole time. You wrote about these fancy book parties and free wine, etc., in a piece called A Debut in the Age of Corona for a UK publication. Mm-hmm. And it's such a great piece. And you say in it,
thank you,
I remember feeling at one point that the structural edits might actually kill me. I'm not the writer they think I am. I said to my husband, I'm going to let everyone down. You know, you go on to say, I can't stuff this up. This is my one shot. What if it's a fluke? What if it's a fluke? And I can only imagine that having arrived with this Cinderella-esque kind of feeling, that the pressure is so huge. So, Anna, you are 1 week away now from your book hitting shelves. Where are you on that roller coaster of feelings right now?
Oh, my God. You know how being a mum is like feeling all the feelings at once?
I do.
It's like that. At any given moment, I'm feeling it all. Like, there sort of is no roller coaster. It all happens at once. It's quite schizophrenic. I am simultaneously flying high on a wave of joy and gratitude and amazement, and also terrified that, you know, actually the book is terrible and people will hate it. I'm terrified that I won't be able to do it again. I'm terrified, that it's a fluke, or maybe like I might actually wake up and it's just been a dream. Do you know what I mean?
Like, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, to begin like that, big international auction, 2-book deal, the rest of it, you can't, people talk about managing expectations, but there's a level of expectation that comes with a deal like that, which means you have to prepare for the book being big. Did anyone give you good advice about managing those expectations along the way, or how have you been managing them for yourself?
It's a really hard thing to answer because it has felt so chaotic in a way. And like I said, everything sort of feels like it's happened at the one time. And also I've got absolutely zero benefit of hindsight in this moment. Yeah. Like I'm in it and I mean, I'm really thankful that the people that I've ended up working with are wonderful, kind, generous, brilliant people who I really trust. Mm-hmm. You know, I really trust that they have had and continue to have my best interests at heart in a personal way as well as a professional way. So I felt very comforted by that. In terms of managing expectations, everybody's just been very, very open and communicative. Like I have felt very included at every stage. I'm copied in on, well, maybe I'm not copied in on all the emails. I wouldn't know. Made me feel like I'm copied in on all the emails. I get asked what I think about so many things that, you know, sometimes I'm like, I don't know. You go ahead and make that decision. I don't know, but they ask me, and it's very in that way they've made me feel very much part of the process, very much in control. Martin at a firm keeps saying, you know, you're the boss. Remember, you're the boss. You're the boss, and that is just such a valuable thing to say to somebody who feels like they have been thrown into a washing machine. Do you know what I mean?
That's fantastic. That's a great space to be in, and also to recognize that that's what's happening to you, because that is so much of that autonomy feels like it's taken away from you as soon as you become part of a publishing house, that you can feel like things are getting out of control or that you're not sure about them. So that feels like it's been a great experience.
A great experience, really, really positive. I think one of the benefits of going with a smaller publisher is that, you know, Martin, who is, you know, one of the company directors, you know, he's also one of my editors. And so I'm working really closely with him. There's no kind of channels through which we've got to go. Whereas in the US and in the UK, they're much bigger publishing houses. And so I do feel a little bit like over there, it's just a much bigger machine. And so it's a slightly different process in terms of decision making and all of that, and that there are more people involved. And there have been points with those guys where I have sort of not in any way felt out of control per se. I'm just very aware that it's a bigger machine.
Yes.
And that there are things outside of just outside of our jurisdiction, if you know what I mean.
Oh, it's so interesting. We'll come back to how it is right now, but I want to go backwards now. I read your amazing piece in Sunday Life finding your voice and your background in theatre and in acting. So let's go back. You say that you were always an artsy kid and that you were always reading. What were the books that you loved as a child?
So many things. All right, what comes to mind immediately is Roald Dahl. My dad read me Roald Dahl at bedtime and did all the accents and all the voices, and I was completely transported. Growing older, I was obsessed with the point horror books. Christopher Pike, Stein, obsessed, like loved everything really dark. I was also, I had a strange obsession, this is going back again to being a bit younger, a strange obsession with Greek mythology. And I just was obsessed with all of those stories, you know, Pyramus and Thisbe, Glaucus and Scylla, the Minotaur, Orpheus and Eurydice. Going forward again, after my point horror phase, I had a huge Terry Pratchett obsession, fantasy and kind of sci-fi horror. Terry Pratchett was like I was a legit fan, and I would find out when his signings would be, you know, I would go and queue up and hand my books over. I had this enormous collection of all his books, and I got rid of them. I gave them. No, don't. I am properly traumatized. It was awful. My mum said to me at one point, I think we were moving house, and she was like, we really need to declutter and get rid of a lot of stuff. And I think I was probably only about 15 or 16, and I was like, oh, okay, I'll clear out my bookshelves. I donated them to charity, and then afterwards, like, I feel like inside I've never stopped crying. They were all signed. I think largely they were like the first editions, and so
many books. You love all of this stuff, but then you say that theatre stole your heart. Tell me, what was it like being at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, Anna Downes?
It was amazing. I will never, ever forget the day I got the call to say that I had a place. I actually did my final audition for them on my 21st birthday. So just the whole journey felt incredibly special. But to be there, again, was kind of like feeling all the feelings at once, because, you know, you have these moments where you see Richard Attenborough, and you're chatting to Richard Attenborough, and you know, Alan Rickman and Imelda Staunton came in, Diana Rigg, they came in to give us talks. There were people that attended our shows, our showcases, that you'd just be kind of on stage just going, oh my God, such and such is in the audience, this is ridiculous. You know, there's all of that. But it's also really hard work. It was really hard work, and it was incessant. And it's quite bewildering, I think. You know, I actually did a degree before I went there, so I was a little bit older, but there were a lot of people, a lot of my classmates who had come straight from school. You know, they were 18, 19. And it is, yeah, it's relentless. And the focus that they expect from you, you know, and the homework that you have to do even after school has finished, it was just, and that there are all these people who were away from home for the first time, and certainly I did not know who I was during those years at all. And it was difficult in a work sense, it was difficult emotionally, but it was also absolutely brilliant fun. The people that I was in classes with, they were just, you know, we were all very close, and yeah, it was great. It was wonderful. Like a kind of real kind of normal, ordinary sense of, this is what we're doing today. This is the class that we're in. This is what we're going to, you know, this is what we're rehearsing. This is what we're looking at. And then just this kind of overall feeling of, holy God, you know, we're here. But then also a real sense of, I don't know, like a foreboding, because at some point we're going to be released into the world, and you feel very cocooned, I think, in those sorts of institutions. And it's quite difficult being released afterwards.
It's that experience there obviously directly links into where you are now in your writing, because you've got your character in The Safe Place who has got a background in acting, but also the idea that the lessons that you learnt there as a writer are about storytelling. What kinds of lessons were you able to take from those years studying that you can kind of have directly put into your writing, do you think?
Well, I think one thing that I definitely remember, I remember having a class where it was kind of all about studying a particular play, and we would each be given a character and we would be asked to write a like a sort of a monologue, but out of the action, you know, outside of the action, like a kind of a behind the scenes sort of monologue. And we did a lot of that. We did a lot of imagining the inner life of a character that you don't necessarily see on the stage. We also, in acting classes, we would do a lot of work around inhabiting your imagined environment, inhabiting your, you know, the stage set, and making it your own. And I think those little things have been immensely valuable in not just imagining the plot and the action, but really the detail of a character or the detail of a scene. And yeah, just kind of constant, 3 years of constant imagination and play. And rhythm as well, your rhythm of a character, that, you know, how to build the character in terms of their inner pace, their inner beat. Yeah, loads and loads of different things.
So you spend time working in TV, in theatre, while you're in the UK, and then at some point you go travelling and you spend some time as a live-in housekeeper. Can you tell us just a little bit about that experience?
So I was there because I had decided that acting didn't make me happy anymore, and it was very difficult. And I experienced a few setbacks. So I lost my agent through a kind of a technicality, which was that's another story. But I found myself freewheeling a little bit and having a bit of a kind of crisis in terms of, I don't really know where to go next. I don't know what to do in this moment. So at the time, I was very into snowboarding, and so I said to the agent that I had at the time, I think I'm going to take a break. I'm going to go and do something that I've never done before and pursue a bit of a hobby, because I feel a bit disillusioned. The other thing, you know, obviously with acting, you're waiting by the phone a lot. You can't book your holidays in case you miss that, you know, the opportunity of a lifetime. And so I was like, I just want to go away. I just want to go and travel and do something different, just for, I don't know, maybe 4 months or something. So I got a job in a ski season, and I met my now husband at that ski season. And while we were there, because we were working for a chalet company, and while we were there, we met a family who owned a very large property down on the Midwest coast of France. And they said, oh, we just happened to have lost our current caretaker / housekeepers. I don't suppose you two would be interested in doing that for a summer. So I just never went back to London. I was just, we just kind of kept traveling. And it was a bit rude, actually. I sent an email to the agent that I had at the time. I was just like, yeah, I'm done. Thanks very much. Bye bye. and so off we went into the sunset, and we worked for 6 months at a time. We did it twice on this incredible estate. And it had, you know, it's pretty much exactly how it's described in The Safe Place. There were two houses and a pool, and it was right on the ocean. And it felt very remote. It was really kind of rural coastal France. It was extraordinary. And the family themselves, I'm still in touch with them. I'm still friends with them. They were brilliant and wonderful, and nothing horrible happened while
I was going to ask that. I was like, no. But Anna, they were nice, right? Because what really happens in really the safe nice. Place is not. And I wanted to check that. Like, how do they feel about the book coming out? Have they read it?
Well, she's read it. And I think her daughter has read it as well, who was 4 when we worked for them.
Wow.
So this is like, you know, 10, 12 years ago. She sent me a couple of emails. She was really complimentary. She was very, you know, she's lovely about it. but didn't really go into any sort of big detail about how she sort of feels about it. She was just like, this is really great. This is great. Lovely. Well done.
It's so good. It's so good. So I want to ask then about when you start to write, because you've got this long history in acting. You're now in Australia. You've got small kids at this point. Tell me about where the story came from and when it got onto the page.
Well, I've actually got I've got some notes here because I arrived in Australia in 2011, and it wasn't until 2013 that I even really thought about doing anything at all. And really that was just a matter of saying to myself, look, you need some kind of creative outlet. I had no interest in going back to acting. It was too difficult. And I wouldn't have known how to kind of insert myself into that industry at that point. And also, yeah, I mean, with writing, you can just go into a room, sit down and put some words down. And that, so that felt like a quite nice and easy way to be creative, just for my own pleasure. So in May of 2013, I went to Sydney Writers Festival and I did a couple of workshops, one of which was with the British author Scarlett Thomas, who was talking about, like, she's got a great book called Monkeys with Typewriters. And in it, she has a kind of an ideas matrix. So you can kind of, it's just a good, quick and easy way to figure out what you know and, you know, how you might make a story out of it. So there were a few things like that that were helpful in terms of inspiring a few ideas, but I didn't really do anything about it. It's just that kind of thing of, oh yeah, one day. And then my second child, I have a son and a daughter. She was born in 2016. And unlike my son, she never slept. Just never. I did not sleep for 8 months. There didn't seem to be any reason for it at all. You know, we obviously explored why, but she still doesn't really sleep that well. It's just one of those things. But unfortunately, you know, the sleep deprivation coupled with the fact that I was so far away from my own home and, you know, my own friends and family, but also, you know, I'm a little bit of an anxious person anyway. I like to be in control. And I think all of those things, it just snowballed and I ended up with just chronic postnatal anxiety. And it was really crippling. I was advised to, you know, go out for coffee more with friends or try and get some exercise or, you know, do some things for yourself. But the only thing I wanted to do was try and be creative, because I felt very worthless personally. I felt, you know, every tiny thing that went wrong felt like a personal failure. It felt like a catastrophe. And I felt like outside of the kids as well, I didn't have any sense of purpose or sense of self-worth. And when I looked into the future, you know, I couldn't see who I was going to be. I couldn't see what I was going to contribute to anything. And I got myself into a right mess. So in January of 2017, I was like, okay, well, I've got to do something. So I locked myself in the bedroom and I sat down with a laptop and I wrote a scene. And it was pretty dreadful, but it was there, it existed, and I had a really nice time that day. You know, so the next day I kind of did a little bit more and a little bit more, and it kind of went on from there. And then in May of 2017, so that's, yeah, it was just a few months of kind of mucking around. In May of 2017, I had this idea. And again, I went to Sydney Writers Festival and I did some workshops. And one of those workshops was, it was an editing workshop. So ridiculous, really, in terms of, you know, I really wasn't at that stage. But I was just like, I'll just take anything at all.
Hungry for it.
Yeah, hungry for just, like, you know, the content, but also the connection, just to sit in a room with other people who were doing it. Because at that point as well, you know, it wasn't just that I'd moved away from London and left behind my own creativity, but I'd left my people behind as well. And we moved to my husband's hometown on the Central Coast, and there weren't really any kind of creative people. There are lots and lots of lovely people, but there was still that part of me that wasn't being
nourished.
Yeah. So, I just signed up for whatever. I was like, yeah, I'll do it all. Whatever's going, I'll do it. And so I ended up in this workshop, and it was run by Lex Hurst, who's now at, Pantera. And it was very inspiring and very exciting. And at the end of it, she called me over and she was like, I think your idea has a lot of potential, actually. And when you're done with the first draft, I think I know somebody, like a colleague of mine, who'd be really interested. So here's my card. And, like, and I was like, and that was a moment where, like, I kind of flew from that workshop, and I was meeting my sister down at the opera bar, at the opera house. And my feet didn't touch the ground.
Oh.
And I turned up at the bar and I was like, I can do this. I can bloody do this. I can do it. I can feel it. I can feel it. I know that I can do it. And I can see it. I can see how I'm going to do it. And it's going to happen. And it was sort of like this weird sort of visualization moment where I was like, all right, this is going to happen. And it. And so then, you know, if this were a movie, cue the montage sequence of the next sort of 12 months, which involved, writing a lot. I actually also sort of thought forward to submissions. So I started to write a few short stories and send those off. Some of those were basically shaping the chapters of the book that I was writing into sort of whole vignettes. So I sent some of those off. I got shortlisted for one prize, longlisted for another. I had... Oh God, what else happened? In August of that year, I saw an interview. I read an interview in a British publication with Jane Harper, who mentioned that she had done a course with Curtis Brown Creative. So onto the computer I went and I looked it up, and she actually did, I think, a longer selective entry course. But they also do these shorter non-selective entry courses that are just sort of like nuts and bolts stuff. And they've got really good content, but you also get like a student forum. So again, you're in a room, a virtual room, but in a room with like minds. And that was incredibly inspiring. You know, I found some wonderful beta readers, you know, made some great connections on that course. But it was also, it's just keeping the fires stoked, keeping inspired, and having a little bit of accountability, so a deadline to work towards, because we were expected each week to hand in a piece of work. So that really helped. I used NaNoWriMo. I entered my pitch into something called the Book Doctors Pitchapalooza, which got selected for a kind of a public vote thing. So that was great. And one of my short stories, so one of these chapters that I'd shaped, actually got accepted and was published in a US literary magazine called Zodiac Review. And that was the first time that anything had been accepted by anyone. And that was ridiculous. That was a real thrill. And that was the kind of moment where I was like, this is working. Yeah, we're on the ladder. Let's go.
It's amazing. I want to say a couple of things here. It's such a good story. Firstly, that I was nearly in tears when you were sharing that story of you know, with your daughter and the sleeplessness and just feeling like so trapped, because I think, you know, thank you for sharing that with us, because I think so many women in particular have that experience and can't see the way out of it, which you evidently ultimately did, which I think is incredible. But also, what sometimes happens when we hear stories like yours, Anna, in terms of what we see on the outside, which is this woohoo, hot, amazing debut that's come from nowhere, is that we forget all the incredible work, and not just the work of writing the manuscript, but you were doing that work of networking. You were doing the work of going to the festivals and meeting the people and listening and understanding how you had to do it and submitting. And I just think that's such an incredibly powerful story for other writers to hear, because it's not that you just suddenly spring from nowhere with your manuscript and say, here it is, cue the champagne. It's an incredible amount of work. So when you're at this point, you're getting these like tiny little, carrots along the way that is like, keep going. I know I've got this. When do you get to the point where you sign with an agent or you get that kind of magic moment? What was that?
So July. So actually, going back to the Curtis Brown Creative course, I did two of them, and one of them was called Edit and Pitch. So that was about teaching you how to, you know, interrogate your material and how to edit it properly, but also how to put your submissions package together. And that was invaluable. The information that I got on that course was, it was honestly, it was like, these are the instructions, just follow them, which is, you know, what I did. But also what they say to you is you have to do your research. And I did months and months and months of researching agents, finding out who might be a good fit for me. And actually, some of the people that I queried, I didn't query them because I'd necessarily heard of them or that I'd, you know, that the agencies were especially renowned. I queried them because they seemed to like the same things that I did. And they seemed to be a kind of, you know, and you can find that information everywhere. It feels very opaque when you first start looking at it, but the more you chip away at the internet, the deeper you can get in there. And there's so much information. So on that course, they said one of the tasks was craft a cover letter to your ideal agent. So I crafted this cover letter, and when the course was over, I submitted it. And that was my first submission to an agent, and it was a London agent. And I got a form rejection back, fine, no problem. But I was like, right, all right. So what that says is that it's not quite right yet. Why isn't it quite right? Let's have a look again at those instructions. Let's have a real think about. And I sent it to I sent the whole manuscript to a few trusted readers, a few of these beta readers that I'd met, got some great feedback. And then in September, I was ready to submit again. And at that point, I'd got maybe 9. So on the course, they said that if you're in Australia, you're kind of straddling all the territories. You know, if you're in the UK, it's probably better to submit to a UK agent. If you're in the US, the same. But if you're in Australia, you can submit to the ones in your own country, but you can probably also go to the US and the UK as well. So that's what I did. I had like, you know, 3 in each territory, and I sent them out. And I got my first reply was from a US agent. She replied within 10 hours with requests for a full manuscript.
Oh my goodness. That gives me the shivers.
My second response was, because I didn't do them all at once. I did them over a few days. And my second response was from an agent who is, she's with a US agency, but she's based in Sydney. And she got back to me within 4 minutes, 10 minutes,
oh my
something
goodness.
Like that. It was like, press send. And then you have that moment where you sit back and go, okay, well, that's done, that's sent. And then it was like, oh, yes.
Wow.
Yes, I will send you the full manuscript. Thank you very much for your interest. Yes. So, and then it was very furious. It all happened very quickly from there because I had a few phone calls quite quickly after that. And then I was able to go back to those other agents and say, I've actually just had an offer. And they would say, well, can you tell me who it is? Yes, I can. It's these people. And they go, oh, okay. And so then it all started moving quite quickly. I had quite a few offers. And weirdly, a few of those agents actually work together. So they're not at the same agency, but they're affiliated.
Yep.
So, you know, if someone in the UK wants to sell their book in the US, they might approach a particular agent over there and say, can you represent it in that country? So there was one offering agent who was like, all right, hang on. Let me just, you know, who's offered? Okay, I know those people. I work with those people. Let me get on the phone to them. And they kind of created like a bit of a co-agenting arrangement. So I ended up with three.
It's amazing. And how, at that point, were they the three that were top of, you know, did you have top of your list out of those 9 that you'd sent to? How did you make that final decision? Or was it just that when they made that kind of co-offer, you were like, okay, yes, this is ideal. This is the best case scenario.
No, it was more about talking to them on the phone. I mean, obviously it was the best case scenario, but they just happened to be, definitely top of my list. And but also having spoken to them, it was clear that we had really good chemistry. I came off the phone with each of them going, oh, yeah, brilliant. And in fact, even though I ended up with three, it was really the Sydney and the US agent that constructed the co-agenting thing.
Okay, so you've got these incredible agents. Did you do a lot of work on the manuscript with them before they sent it out on submission to publishers?
Yeah, so I signed with them in, that was October. They then went away, had a chat, came back to me with some notes, and then I redrafted over Christmas. So I think probably from November to about, I think I handed my redraft in January. It still wasn't quite there. Did another redraft, gave it back to them in February. And then they said, okay, we're ready. We're ready to go on publisher submission. So yeah, it was a lot of work. It was mainly, I think, structural stuff and weeding out a lot of things that didn't need to be there. But yeah, so then we went on publisher submission.
It's such a great story. It's so interesting. Tell me when it was out on submission, and obviously you ended up going with a firm. Can you remember the day, the phone call, the champagne popping? Tell us about it, Anna. What happened?
Oh God. So it was all happening at the same time in Australia, in the US, and the UK. So
just to add to the sleeplessness that you're having at this point.
Well, and actual sleeplessness as well, because obviously a lot of the US and UK emails are coming in overnight. Yeah. So it was all happening. I went to Sydney to meet in person with a few of the offering publishers. That was like the best week of my whole life. Oh my God, like the fact that these people, these exalted professionals, were pitching to me was just unbelievable. And they were all so nice. I wanted to work with them all.
Of course.
So that was very exciting. And I had a lot of phone calls with people in the US as well and in the UK. And then it was just kind of a matter of trying to make a choice. The fact that I even had a choice was just ridiculous. And I think there were a few moments. The moment that I got my first offer through, that was crazy, because at that point, even though you've got these agents and you're on publisher submission, there's no guarantee that anybody's going to want it. And I actually have since spoken to quite a few authors who have been through that experience and they haven't sold.
Yeah.
So I was really lucky. When that first offer came through, I was at a friend's house and the kids were running riot, and I got it through on email and I just cried. I just cried. The reality, it was like, just pinch me, wake me up kind of thing. I'm getting all flustered just thinking about it. It was so exciting.
It is very exciting. The whole process of it has been.
Yeah. But yes, and then we flew down to Victoria to meet with a firm, and made that decision, locked it in and haven't looked back.
Tell me, you have known that this book was coming out. This is this big July 2020 release. It's the, thriller of the year. And then we get COVID.
COVID.
COVID. So I know it's kind of a moot point even to talk about how book release has changed for you because of this. What were you most looking forward to that has had to be cancelled, and have there been so far any silver linings in terms of what the rest of the year and promotion looks like?
Oh, well, I mean, let me just say the whole thing is a silver lining, right? It doesn't look like what I thought it would look like, but it's still happening.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I, even when I've had my moments of disappointment, and I certainly have had those, to keep reminding myself, like, it's still happening. I've still done something very cool. You know, these things are not going to go away. So that is the silver lining. What was the other question? Sorry.
So what were you so looking forward to just before we started recording? Yeah. You were saying, like, I will get on a boat to go down and visit bookstores somewhere else.
So when I first got the publishing deal, I remember having a conversation where, you know, we were kind of brainstorming how, you know, what I could bring to the table as an author. And I'm just like, I cannot wait. I'm quite an extrovert, you know, I love getting amongst it and talking to people. And I was like, I can't wait to meet the booksellers. I can't wait to meet them. I can't wait to talk to people about books. I can't wait to do the festivals. Oh my God. You know, I can't wait to get on the stage and speak to people and do panel events. And like, that's been a big disappointment, because it's almost like that was going to be my superpower.
Yeah,
that was going to be my thing that I would do, and I can't do it. So that's been very disappointing. It has felt very sad to me that I won't get to do that bookshop launch and, you know, have the in-person loving that I thought I would have.
Yep.
But again, it's still happening. It just looks different. The whole thing about getting on a boat was about, you know, at the moment, some of the states, you know, we have opened our borders. You can technically get down to them. I'm only doing bookshop visits in New South Wales, which is really exciting. I do get to do some of them. Wonderful. Brilliant. I'll take it. Fantastic. But I did have a conversation where I was, you know, my publishers were like, oh, we can't really get you down to Victoria and, you know, ACT, even though the borders are open. It's kind of, we kind of need to err on the safe side. And I'm like, what? It's open. Put me, I will get in a car. I will drive down. Like, where do you need me to be? I will get on a boat. I will sail there. I will do anything. What do you want me to do? And I will do it. Just let me at him. But I can't. I have to be safe.
I think that one of the things is that even on Zoom, your absolute exuberance and joy for the book world will come through. So I have no doubt that people will see that. And of course, you know, further on with book two, etc. Tell me, you signed a 2-book deal. You know, everyone says, oh, don't sign a 2-book deal. You know, the pressure, etc., etc. I, of course, didn't listen to them either and did it myself. Yeah. But have you been able to get into the writing of book two, or are you leaving that aside for another time?
No, God, I'm on a deadline. I'm late for the deadline, actually. So I have very much had to get on with it. And I almost had to get on with it, as you know, whilst I was doing edits for The Safe Place.
Yeah.
I've been productive during COVID as much as I can. Anyway, obviously, I've had my kids at home and there's been homeschooling involved. And I've gone back to writing in snatches and getting up at 4:30 and all of those things. There's been no routine. I have been productive. I have produced words, but they've almost been the wrong words. It's like I've written a different book. So I've got kind of 20,000 unusable words currently. I don't have a problem with being productive per se. I always make sure that I get the work done, but you sometimes can't help what comes out. And unfortunately, what came out was just, obviously my brain was so muddled and I was so distracted I wasn't on track with the actual story that I was writing. I kind of wrote a different one. So, still going with it. At the moment, I'm probably about 2/3 of the way through the first draft, and I'm trying to be efficient. I'm trying to stick to a plan. I've got a to-do list, you know, every day. I've got little tasks that I need to complete on it. But of course, I'm also doing written content for online stuff. Publicity is really starting to kick off now. And so, yeah, it's very busy.
Tell me, Anna, were there lessons from the editing or from just the writing process for The Safe Place that you went, okay, I'm going to immediately take that on board for the writing of book two, for instance, with planning or with getting a word count down every day, any of those kinds of lessons that you've shifted for book two?
Yeah, definitely. The editing process teaches you so much. It was a complete eye opener for me. Certainly I think some of the things that came up, like, pacing, I think is a big one. And in terms of, you know, planning, I think, you know, one of the big things about The Safe Place, I mean, it still is a bit of a slow burn at the beginning, but it was even more so when I first submitted it and they were like, you know, you need to get straight into the action. So that's something that I brought forward with me. I'm right in there from the first line with this next one. Yeah, so there's loads and loads and loads of lessons that I've learned. I mean, I kind of planned with The Safe Place anyway. I sort of pantsed it for about the first 25,000 words and then was like, oh, I don't really know how to progress here. And that's when I started planning. I'm kind of working in a similar way in that I am... I can't help but stop and kind of go back and re-edit a little bit. So it's almost like two steps forward, one step back. So I'm kind of constantly layering as I go. I did try to, you know, vomit out the first draft, as some people say. But yeah, I wrote 20,000 of the wrong words. So I think it's better. I mean, I'm still learning how I work. I'm so useless. I've got such a huge amount to learn still. But I think I am... somebody that doesn't, I'm not able to write a first draft quickly. And the discovery, you know, I make discoveries about characters and about plot because I'm moving slowly. So I don't think I'm able to just write it quickly and then go, oh, look at that. Like, I sort of have to do it in the writing, if you know what I mean.
I do. Yeah. Is it The Safe Place is a thriller, a cracking thriller, very, very difficult to put down once you're into it. Are you writing in that kind of vein again? And what kind of lessons are you taking? What inspiration are you taking to craft that very particular element of story, which means that you grab your reader and you hold onto them and you do not let them go? Where are you getting your lessons from?
It's a really hard question, particularly in the first draft. I think a lot of that comes in the editing.
Yeah.
With what I'm doing at the moment, I am definitely trying to bear it in mind. And I think probably I work quite visually. It's more like what I can see happening that helps with that. Do you know what I mean? Like all the showing rather than the telling.
Yeah.
You know, show it in every possible way that you can. Show it what it looks like, put it in action. So I think, you know, but then obviously in the editing, you pair it back so that what you're showing the reader is quick. And it's like, what is the kernel of the information that you want to convey here? What's the most important thing? Like, say a scene is a room. You go, you walk in the room, what's the first thing you see? What's the most important thing in that room? And then you show it in the quickest, most efficient way you can, but also hopefully while keeping the language beautiful, I hope, in some way.
You are almost overly qualified to have done your own audiobook, both with your acting background, but also the fact that, you know, you're the writer of it. But I certainly know, like, I've got my pages here next to me because I'm about to do my final proofread. Like, the very thought of reading my words again is making me physically sick. Mm-hmm. How did you stay in the room, keep reading the words, and give it what I imagine is your all? How did you get your head around that, Anna?
It was an amazing experience. I think some of the adrenaline really carried me through the first half of it. I was so excited to be there. It was such an amazing thing to be doing, particularly given where I've come from. I was so happy to be given the opportunity to do that. Another good thing was actually, I mean, it was kind of weird. I expected there to be a director or somebody there who would be giving me a bit of guidance along the way. You know, don't do it like that, do it like this. Maybe that's not coming across that well, blah, blah, blah. There was nobody. It was just me in a room and an engineer, producer who hadn't read the book, which is fine, totally yeah. fine. But that was actually, I mean, it was quite nice actually, because then I was telling him the story. Yes. So he was on the other side of the glass, and every time we'd stop, he'd go, "Oh my God." And he'd be giving me his theories as to what was happening.
Oh, and that's great. That. It was so that's nice. Great.
Yeah. So it was like me and this dude for a week, I told him the story. And so that kind of got me through it. But I have to say, the very final few hours of reading it were so painful. There was, I hope it doesn't translate, oh my God, but it was so hard. I was literally reading a line and then I'd read the next one and stuff it up. So he'd take me back, drop me in. I'd do that line and then I'd just stuff the next one up. So it was literally line by line by line because I was so exhausted and I just couldn't even read the words anymore. And like you said, a little bit sick of it.
Yeah.
A little bit sick of it.
Well, luckily no one will be sick of it when they're either reading it or listening to it. I could speak to you all day, but of course I can't because I've already gone over time. Tell me, you are deep in this experience right now. And as you said at the start, quite honestly, you said, I don't even have the benefit of hindsight yet. Is there some advice that you can give other writers who are going through either this period with a first book or even just navigating book release and COVID? What kind of advice might you be able to pass on to our wonderful listeners?
Advice for somebody who's going through what I'm going through right now would be just don't forget how much you love it, because the machine can it can be very overwhelming, and it can also be very, you know, the business side of it. It's important. It's really important. Sales are important. But I think you can get kind of caught up with the logistics. And I certainly have had a few moments where I've been like, I don't just overwhelmed with the detail, with tasks and to-do lists, and the pressure of deadlines. Deadlines is that's a really big thing for somebody who's new to the business. I don't, you know, I've never had to really write to a deadline before, and that's been really hard. But I actually went back to Big Magic and read that again, and I was like, yeah, the joy. I do love it. I do love it so much, and I have to get back to that and reconnect with that. Another thing that I would say is get involved with the community. Find your people, find your friends. I have been blown away by the warmth of the community and other writers, the generosity of other writers, the way in which people have just opened their arms and said, yeah, come on board. Yeah, brilliant. Who are you? What are you about? Let's be friends. It's been so amazing. And therein, I think, lies good networking, is a genuine desire to connect with people and a genuine desire to not just be supported, but support others. So, you know, I'm really lucky. I'm an absolute book nerd. And so not only is this experience really wonderful and valuable for me personally, but it's an incredible privilege to be able to walk into a room and speak to my favorite authors and pick their brains about how they're doing things and tell them how much I love their book. I had the most ridiculously embarrassing experience at a Newcastle Writers Festival where I met Mark Brandy, and I just finished reading both of his books, and I was like, oh, I think you're amazing. I love your books. And he was, you know, very poised, and, you know, he was just, thank you very much, and walked away. And I was just like, oh my God. But yeah, fanning out. Don't be afraid to fan out, I would say to people, because that you'll find your people that way, because you're connecting with people whose work is similar to yours and who are likely to be interested in your work too. And you can all lift each other up. That's been a huge relief to me to find that it's not actually embarrassing or painful to go and speak to people you admire. It's highly rewarding. And I've made some incredible writer friends. Like, they inspire me, and they make me feel very safe And they really keep me grounded as well. You know, they kind of remind me that my experience is really extraordinary and not to take it for granted. So that's my advice.
That's wonderful advice. And I cannot wait to see people and to hear from you when people are starting to come up and fan out at you, because I think it will just be the most glorious experience and you'll probably both be like just shaking hands at each other. It'll be gorgeous.
I hope I can shake hands with you.
Oh, yeah, that's so true. Anna, as always, I want to ask you, like we ask everyone, can you please recommend us a debut book, any time, any genre?
I'm going to be really cheeky and do two. I'm going to say that one of my favorites of all time is The Beach by Alex Garland. When I read that as a first novel, and I read that and I remember being completely electrified by it. That was all the way back in 1996. It's very zeitgeisty in terms of, but it really resonated with me at the time. I was at school and knew a lot of, it's about trust fund kids backpacking around the world. It really captures a particular age, but it's also very interesting, I think, for readers now, because it's about, you know, that there are no smartphones, there's no Wi-Fi, you know, it's a lot about, you know, damaged characters traveling to far-flung corners of the world, to exotic places, in order to find redemption or release or revelation, some kind of revelation about themselves, and finding really terrifying things. And that's one of my favorite kinds of stories. Another excellent debut is coming out this year. Victoria Hanan's Kokomo is so beautiful and so profound and moving and tender, and the way that she meditates on the nature of love is extraordinary.
I'm so looking forward to reading that one, and it's we will have her, we've got her lined up for the podcast as well, which is going to be wonderful. Anna, it has been an absolute joy speaking to you. We wish you all the best with The Safe Place as it heads out into the world, and just hope that you enjoy all the moments of it.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been amazing. I'm having a real I made it moment.
Yes.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website, or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at thefirsttimepod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.